very, I don't think it's going to be, it's not your person.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Eric Lewis, and I represent four former detainees at Guantanamo. They are citizens of our ally, the United Kingdom. They were not captured on a battlefield by American troops. They were never charged with a crime. They were never found to be enemy combatants. They were ultimately released without condition. Nevertheless, they spent more than 2 years at Guantanamo, subject to sustained torture and religious humiliation, devised and implemented by the former Secretary of Defense and senior military officers. This case seeks damages from those individuals. This appeal raises three principal issues. First, did the district court err when it found as a matter of law for purposes of the Westfall Act that torture was within the scope of defendants' employment? Second, did the district court err when it found that it was objectively reasonable for defendants to conclude that it was not illegal to torture my clients? And third, was the district court correct in concluding that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act applied at Guantanamo and that it was clearly established at the time? I'd like to address the Westfall Act question first. The district court erred in wrongly imposing a burden of proof on plaintiffs at the motion to dismiss stage to prove that torture was outside the scope of employment. Our only burden was to rebut the certification of the Attorney General by alleging facts that would create a material issue on the scope of employment issue. Under D.C. law, as most recently affirmed by this court in the Maggiano case, scope of employment is a quintessential question of fact for a trier of fact. The very few cases that have found that discovery and an evidentiary hearing were not necessary dealt only with cases where the behavior was so egregious that courts found no reasonable jury could have found that the conduct was within the scope of employment. Maggiano made clear that it cannot be determined as a matter of law that conduct is within the scope of employment, only when it's outside the scope of employment. We submit, Your Honors, that torture is sui generis, that ordering torture can never be authorized or incident to authorized conduct. As the Supreme Court stated in Sosa and this court in Tellurin, under international law, the torturer is the enemy of all mankind. You cannot be the enemy of all mankind and still be acting within your job description.
So your first three counts are invoking for jurisdiction the Alien Tort Statute, and the cause of action is customary international violation of customary international law. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. And then we have a Bivens count as well, Your Honor.
You have a what?
A Bivens count, which precedes 1350 is the basis.
Is that the first three counts customary, or is it first two counts?
The first. I believe it's the first three. It's indefinite and arbitrary detention,
right,
and torture and religious humiliation.
Okay.
On the Westfall Act, it is not simply that torture is not within the scope of employment. It is the opposite. It is the antithesis of what the Secretary of Defense and senior military officers are hired to do. It is their job description to prevent torture, to train their troops, not to torture, to inculcate the core principles since the founding of our country. And I believe that the retired military officer's brief is eloquent on the subject of the long-standing tradition that American troops are trained that there is a core value not to torture prisoners in military custody. Now, the government has created a material issue of fact here. First, they certify that it's within the scope of employment, and yet it is the government's position and I quote from the government's report to the United Nations, "A commanding officer who orders such punishment, that is torture, would be acting outside the scope of his or her position and would be individually liable for the intentional infliction of bodily and emotional harm." At the very least, that is a question for the jury. And the district court construed some of the more extreme cases on scope of employment under local law incorrectly in stating that if a laundromat attendant is acting within the scope of his employment in shooting a patron, or a delivery man is acting within the scope of employment in raping a customer, surely torture is within the scope of employment. But those cases, Weinberg and Lyon, don't find that that activity is within the scope of employment. All they find is consistent with Maggiano, it's creating an issue of fact. And the Army Distaff case and the DC Television case both hold that where there is an official statement by an employer, or the employer explicitly forbids the conduct.
Those cases stand for a bit more than that, don't they? The cases, as I see it, stand for the proposition that simply because the action taken by the employee is illegal, that doesn't take it out of the scope of employment, even though the employer certainly didn't want his employees to commit illegal acts.
That's correct, Your Honor. The fact that it's illegal per se does not take it outside the scope of employment, but with seriously criminal conduct.
The government takes it one step further then and says that, look, a rape is abhorrent. It's terrible. Yet it could be within the scope of employment. Why is torture is illegal? It's abhorrent. Why doesn't it follow that torture can be within the scope of employment?
I would make 2 points in response to that. First, if conduct is seriously criminal, that is a factor for a trier of fact to consider. The fact that it is seriously criminal does not make it per se outside the scope of employment, but that is for a trier of fact to decide. And second, I would submit that those cases which are dealing with finding someone to pay a tort judgment are very different from a Secretary of Defense ordering torture. He is not the typical employee. In fact, he is the one who is giving the orders.
But who's the trier of fact here? It's the judge, right?
Well, under Maggiano, it indicates that it would be a jury. Under Kimbrough versus Velton, the initial suggestion was that it would be an evidentiary hearing before a court after discovery. And Kimbrough versus Velton ordered that evidentiary hearing. But Maggiano,
in the Westfall Act situation, it can't be the jury that determines whether the United States should be substituted or not.
Well, under the clear,
that's a preliminary question. It's got to be the judge.
Maggiano said that it was a jury question, Your Honor. That was a very recent case in the D.C. Circuit. We think there's certainly a right to an evidentiary hearing after discovery, but Maggiano seemed to move from Kimbrough versus Velton and suggest that it was a jury issue. Whether jury or judge.
It was the Smithsonian, was it?
Maggiano was a Smithsonian, and it was a Westfall Act certification.
Yeah.
I believe Your Honor was on.
Yeah,
on
I was.
Panel.
I was. Yes. I just don't remember that aspect of saying it's a jury question.
Maggiano did state that it was a jury question. I don't know whether it wasn't central at what point it should be considered, but it is certainly a question for a trier of fact, whomever that trier of fact would be.
Well, let's assume it's the judge.
Yes.
Okay. Then the question, the real question is whether you should have had discovery first.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right. But what exactly would that discovery entail?
Well, under Section 229 of the Restatement, there are certain factors which are relevant to the judge's consideration. Is this the type of conduct commonly done by persons in defendant's position? What is the extent of the departure from authorized conduct, and is it seriously criminal? We would submit that there's ample documentation within the government that would be relevant to that. Defendant's training, for example. What are the training of senior military officers and the Secretary of Defense with respect to torture? What do the field manuals say? What do policy documents say? What do JAG opinions say? What reports are done? What are the disciplinary records with respect to abuse? What documents and positions were considered in formulating the position of the United States that, in fact, an individual would be individually liable in reporting that to the United Nations Convention Against Torture. The military works on paper. There is much paper that would be relevant to this. Some of it has already been made public, and we think it would be within the discretion of the district court to manage that discovery in a way that was reasonable and not overly intrusive, but which would show that no Secretary of Defense has ever ordered torture, that no general has ever permitted torture, that the military abhors torture, and that the military views as one of its core functions to prevent its troops from abusing prisoners in custody.
You there are, what, four or five factors under the restatement for which the district follows for determining scope of employment. And the government says that the only one you're contesting is the first factor. Is this of a kind that the whatever it is it's
Yes, that's not accurate. First, is it the kind of conduct they are employed to perform? Right. We would submit that torture is precisely the opposite of the kind of conduct to perform. Now, but there is also a factor in 228 of the restatement that goes to if force is used, whether the use of force is expectable by the master.
Right.
And when the conduct is incident rather than authorized, and I think the government would probably concede that the torture was not authorized but incident to authorized conduct, then Section 229 has a series of 10 factors that are to be considered. And the three factors that I just mentioned, serious criminality, extent of departure, commonly done conduct, are factors which a trier of fact is required to consider in employing the restatement approach that the District of Columbia requires. If I can move on to qualified immunity, Your Honors, in assessing whether it was clearly established that respondents couldn't torture people, the Supreme Court has made clear that this is a pragmatic inquiry. It's not to be done at a high level of abstraction. Is there a due process right out there, as Anderson v. Creighton and Saussure make clear?
Does your qualified immunity argument only go to the Geneva Convention and the Constitution?
It also goes to RFRA, Your Honor.
And RFRA, okay.
Yes.
If it doesn't go to the customary international law claims?
It does not.
Okay. But why should we even get the qualified immunity? I know Judge Urbina said, I'm going to assume, I don't think Boumediene was decided when he handed down his ruling. He said, I'm going to assume the Constitution applies. I'm going to assume the Geneva Convention's judicially enforceable. We've decided a number of times, and we have an outstanding opinion saying, number one, the Constitution does not extend to Guantanamo. Congress has passed the Military Commission Act saying Guantanamo is not part of the sovereign territory of the United States, and we have held that the Geneva Convention is not judicially enforceable. So we don't—I mean, the precedent is there, and we're bound to follow it, so why get the qualified immunity?
Well, why don't we take those one at a time on whether there is a constitutional right to begin with, and whether there's a statutory right. With respect to your comment, with your statement about the Detainee Treatment Act and the Military Commissions Act, it's quite right that those statutes are at present on the books. But those statutes were passed after this case was brought, and those statutes do not apply to my clients because those statutes restrict jurisdiction only for those who have been found to be enemy combatants. And my clients have never been found to be enemy combatants.
Whether Guantanamo is part of the sovereign territory of the United States applies, doesn't it?
Well, whether it's a sovereign territory of the United States does not go to the issue of whether it's a territory in possession under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
Put that aside for the minute, because I think that's a red herring. But just let's just deal with the other part. You've got the Supreme Court in Eisentrager said that the Constitution does not apply beyond the sovereign territory of the United States. We have that holding. Maybe the Supreme Court are going to reverse it. Maybe it's going to change it. But there's nothing we can do about it. Right? That's my point.
Sure. Let's first, Boumediene, the mandate has been withdrawn. Yeah. So we would submit that Boumediene at present does not constitute binding law. It is an opinion of this court. The mandate has been withdrawn. It does not bind those parties. The Supreme Court obviously will speak. Second,
you don't need, even if Boumediene is, even if you're right about that, and you're not, by the way, but even if you're right that because the mandate hasn't issued, it's not a precedent, you've still got People's Mujahideen, you've got 32 sovereignty, you've got I can't remember all the cases.
Yes, Your Honor, but first of all, none of those cases dealt with torture. And under Brown versus Mississippi, torture is a fundamental right. It's been held, it offends some principle of justice so rooted in traditions and the conscience of our people. Under the Zavidas case, Justice Scalia, in his dissent, where he said that these aliens who were not in the United States had no rights, said, well, of course you couldn't torture them. And we would submit, Your Honor, that torture is different, and with qualified immunity is judge-made law, and that as a matter of policy, it would be wrong to permit immunity in the case of torture. But even with respect to the right, Rasool, in reversing this court in Al-Oda, said that the conduct alleged, and it wasn't torture, it was detention, unquestionably describes conduct. Now, to be sure, that is not a holding, that is dicta, but that we would submit it's persuasive dicta. So an Eisentrager dealt with an enemy alien, these are not enemy aliens, who were convicted of war crimes. My clients have never been charged or convicted of anything, who were held in their home country, not in a wholly owned military base that the Supreme Court has decided in Rasool for those purposes.
They were convicted by a military commission in China.
They were convicted by military. They were German nationals convicted in China and then brought to Germany where they were confined.
In Landsberg prison.
Yes.
You better get on to your religious.
Sure. Repertoire. And I would also note, Your Honor, that there is a significant line of cases which holds that aliens outside the U.S. do have Fifth Amendment liberty interests, and those are the personal jurisdiction cases. And in particular, I would.
That was the issue in Eisentrager, is whether the Due Process Clause applied.
It was one of the issues I know there's a dispute about whether it was statutory or constitutional. I think that's a fair question. That's certainly a correct observation. The insular cases, which we submit apply to territories and possessions, speak of fundamental rights. Torture is the most fundamental of fundamental rights. And I would also call the court's attention to the Insurance Company of Ireland case, which found that aliens outside the U.S. who are sued in the U.S. have a liberty interest in not being sued. So I think it is not accurate as a matter of Supreme Court precedent to say that aliens outside the U.S. have no Fifth Amendment due process rights.
Problem is, we've said it.
I agree with that, Your Honor, although I would submit that the Supreme Court's decisions would bind this court in terms of whether there is at least some liberty interest. And so if we have the personal jurisdiction cases out there which say, in terms, it's not a question of competing sovereignties, there's a liberty interest. And we have Eisentrager out there which said, if you're a war criminal, you don't have a liberty interest. Now we're dealing with torture, and I think it's incumbent on this court to look at conflicting Fifth Amendment precedents.
We'd have to embank this case. That's the only real hope you have, is that we embank this case or the Supreme Court reverses Boumediene. But I want to ask you about your religious freedom argument.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, you make the what seems to be a very powerful analogy between that Vermilion Bermuda case involving the Fair Labor Standards Act, and because that case also contained the language territory or possession.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right. And the Supreme Court in that case said that the Bermuda base was no different than Guantanamo.
It did.
Right. So that sounds like a slam dunk for you. There's only one problem. The Bermuda case, I'm going to call it Bermuda, the Bermuda case, used the territory of possession in a geographic sense. It said the Fair Labor Standards Act involved commerce between a territory and possession in the United States, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas in the religious freedom instance, the statute doesn't use it in that sense. It says that the government of a territory or possession cannot violate certain religious freedoms, right? Well, there's no government of Guantanamo Bay.
But it applies.
And you don't need that statute to make it applicable to the military people and the Defense Department people that you sued. You don't need that part of the statute. So I don't understand what the relevance of that territory or possession argument is.
Well, Your Honor, you have a statute. You have a statute.
You understand my.
I do. You have a statute which intends to apply as broadly as possible. And you have a statute which is trying to apply a core value, which is respect for faith. And respect for faith, not just for Americans, but also for all persons. So it speaks to all persons. And it attempts to expand broadly. It's not only been applied to territories and possessions, it's been applied outside the United States in the Veatch case. So you have a statute which, in the very terms of the statute, attempts to apply as broadly as possible. It says all cases of burden on religion, all officials. And while there is no government of at Guantanamo, there are officials who are acting at Guantanamo. The Supreme Court.
You don't need them. You don't need that territory or possession clause to get them under, because they're governed. I mean, at least your argument is that they are officials of the United States. There's no question the statute applies to officials of the United States.
And, Your Honor, when Congress wants to legislate, it creates statutes where it says territories and possessions including Guantanamo, territories and possessions excluding Guantanamo. It can legislate when
you
it
may
says...
You misunderstand me. I'm making an argument in your favor.
Ah, well, then please do, Your Honor. Yes. Yeah, I believe we don't need it, but when we go to qualified immunity in terms of what are the parameters that they are looking at, everything is pointing toward allowing these rights at Guantanamo. And I come back to the Hope versus Pelzer analysis on qualified immunity. The Supreme Court says the touchstone for analysis on qualified immunity is a pragmatic one, and that where the conduct is antithetical to human dignity, where the obvious cruelty inherent in this practice should have provided respondent with notice, that is where you begin. And when you order torture, and when you say, how can we abuse Muslims? Let's sexually taunt them. Let's put their Qurans in the toilet bucket. Okay, you are talking about conduct where the cruelty is obvious and which is antithetical to human dignity. So when a Defense Department official sits down and says, can we do this, he has to begin with that moral intuition, and that is what guides us. As the Supreme Court said in U.S. versus Lanier, the easiest cases don't arise. You don't need a case that says you can't sell foster children into slavery to be held not immune when you sell foster children into slavery. You don't need the specific case. So the easiest cases don't come up. It is simply not correct that the Defense Department could have believed that a statute which applies to the military, which applies at prisons, which states extraterritoriality, the DTA and the MCA are passed afterwards, they exclude this conduct. How can it be contended that they had a good faith belief that it didn't apply here? The Uniform Code of Military Justice, Army Regulation 190.8, everything is saying you can't do this. The military won't let you do it. International law won't let you do it. The Religious Freedom Restoration Act won't let you do it. There's no ambiguity other than this precise case of humiliating Muslims has not been decided before. You don't need the Supreme Court to tell you that putting Qurans in a toilet bucket is something the United States shouldn't be doing. And again, for the court to hold that doing that is something that the Secretary of Defense shouldn't have known would be sending a message in granting qualified immunity for that atrocious conduct, which is at odds with the court's qualified immunity analysis in Hope and in Lanier, and with our deepest held principles and beliefs. Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court, I'm Jonathan Cohn, representing the United States of America and the individual defendants. According to plaintiffs, when the military, in the course of fighting a war, captures aliens abroad, those detainees can turn around and sue high-level DOD officials, including the Secretary himself, and collect monetary damages under novel theories never before adopted by any court. Because plaintiffs are incorrect about this, this court should reject their arguments, affirm the district court on the appeal, and reverse on the cross appeal concerning RFRA. If it pleases the court, I'll begin by addressing the Westfall Act issues, then turn toward the constitutional claims, and then finish up by discussing RFRA. On the Westfall Act issues, plaintiffs failed to mention that their own complaint scuttles their case. As plaintiffs would acknowledge, they have to acknowledge this in light of D.C. Circuit and D.C. Court of Appeals precedent, the scope of employment test comes down to foreseeability, whereas here there's no question about the purpose behind the defendant's actions. The test comes down to foreseeability. If the defendant's conduct, if the employee's conduct was foreseeable, it's within scope. Well, plaintiffs in their own complaint in paragraph 8 expressly allege that the defendant's conduct is foreseeable. They use that word. They say that the defendant's conduct was foreseeable. Because of that fatal allegation, their complaint fails under the precedent of this court and the decisions of the D.C. Court of Appeals. But even if we were to ignore that fatal allegation in this case, their complaint would still fail because the defendant's action was squarely within the scope of their employment. The relevant decision from this court is Ballinger, which makes clear that the relevant question is not to focus upon the particular tort, but the underlying conduct or dispute, which in this case is the promulgation of policies regarding the detention and interrogation of aliens during a war. And unquestionably, that is squarely within the scope of high-level officials of the Department of Defense. Plaintiffs focus upon what they consider to be the egregious conduct, but this court rejected that line of analysis in Ballinger. The focus is not on whether the tort is deleterious or actionable. Indeed, the Westfall Act expressly covers actions that are wrongful. Instead, the focus is on the underlying tort. So, for those reasons, plaintiffs' international law claims fail under the Westfall Act. If it pleases the court, I'll turn to the constitutional claims that plaintiffs raise in this case. And as Judge Randolph pointed out, those claims fail under this court's decision in Boumediene. Frankly speaking, the detainees in Guantanamo do not have constitutional rights. But even if the Supreme Court were to make the erroneous decision in reversing this court in Boumediene, plaintiff's case still fails.
Is that scheduled for argument yet?
It is in December, Your Honor. If the Supreme Court were to reverse, that still would not help plaintiffs for two independent reasons. Number one, there would still be qualified immunity. I mean, at the very least, the law was not clearly established. But second, even ignoring qualified immunity, their case fails because of Bivens' special factors. This court's decision in Sanchez-Espinoza is squarely on point. The special factor in this case is plaintiffs are suing military officials for actions taken during the course of a war. And you just can't do that because of separation of powers concerns. As this court recognized in Sanchez-Espinoza and the Supreme Court recognized in Stanley, uninvited intrusions by the judiciary into military affairs are inappropriate. So even ignoring this court's decision in Boumediene and Giffrey and People's Mujahideen, ignoring the Supreme Court's decisions in Eisentrager and Verdugo, plaintiff's claim still fails under special factors. Accordingly, if it's pleasing to the court, I'll address the RFRA claim in this case.
Is the Geneva Convention claim a separate count?
The Geneva Convention is their fourth claim. They have four international law claims, three based upon customary international law. The fourth is the Geneva Convention. All four of those claims fail, however, under the Westfall Act.
Okay. So the Geneva Convention, the only exception under the Westfall Act is allegations of constitutional violation.
And statutes. But, of course, the Geneva Convention is not a statute. And
it's not the Constitution either.
So. Exactly. So it's neither a statute nor the Constitution. So if it's pleasing to the court, I'll turn to the final.
And before you leave the scope of employment, there's something I read in here that it seems ironic that that the respondeat superior principle that's being invoked here in the usual situation in the District of Columbia is to get to a deep pocket. It's a favorable doctrine for plaintiffs. The plaintiffs don't want to have to be restricted to suing the employee. They'd rather go after the employer, right?
That's correct.
And it shouldn't be, this is strange because it's, you know, what it's doing is restricting recovery, but that's not true, is it? I mean, if who would you rather have holding the money bag would be the United States. Right? All this does is substitute the United States. The only reason the plaintiffs lose is because they have not exhausted their administrative remedies.
They'd lose for other reasons as well, but you hit the nail on the head, Your Honor. Under plaintiff's theory of scope of employment, they're actually making things better for the United States in the long run, and they're punishing future plaintiffs. Under their theory, let's take a prisoner, a U.S. citizen here in the United States. Under their theory, a prison guard could egregiously, maliciously, and seriously beat the life out of the prisoner, and because it's so serious and egregious, it's outside of scope, and therefore the U.S. cannot be sued under the FTCA. That's their theory,
right?
Which makes little sense.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
So I'll turn to the RFRA claim, which fails for a couple reasons, but the only issue the court needs to address is whether the word person in RFRA covers aliens abroad. RFRA bestows rights only on persons, which in the constitutional sense does not include aliens abroad, as this court recognized in Boumediene, Jiffrey, People's Mujahideen, as the Supreme Court recognized in Verdugo and Eisentrager. Person in the constitutional sense does not include aliens abroad.
The Eighth Amendment doesn't use the word person. The Fifth Amendment does.
That's right. Correct.
And the decision in Eisentrager reversed the decision of this court. Using the argument that this court's decision in Eisentrager said that person is unbounded geographically, and therefore the Fifth Amendment applies to aliens abroad. I don't know if you realize that. That was the argument of this circuit that Eisentrager reversed. So that's your argument.
That's correct, Your Honor. The Supreme Court in Eisentrager, and then again in Verdugo, acknowledged that in the constitutional sense, person does not include aliens abroad.
But it applies, that the statute applies to military bases.
It does apply to military bases, but that does not mean it gives rights to aliens abroad in military bases that are overseas. Only persons have rights under RFRA, so even if the U.S. servicemen overseas are bound by RFRA with respect to U.S. citizens, something we don't concede, but we consume arguendo, that would not mean that the aliens abroad who are detained by the U.S. servicemen have any rights under RFRA, because RFRA bestows rights.
So if our military base in Guam, the individuals who are aliens in the prison in Guam don't have any rights, but the individuals who are citizens of the United States do?
Well, Guam being one of the insular territories, that's a different case, because even the inhabitants over there, first of all, they're U.S. citizens, but even the aliens who are over there, because they're on U.S. territory and they're not abroad, because they're not abroad, they would be considered persons in the constitutional sense, and hence they have rights under RFRA.
Uh-huh. I'm sorry, I maybe misunderstood what you were saying, but is your argument that aliens abroad are not persons within the meaning of RFRA?
Within the meaning of RFRA, that's correct, Your Honor, because...
Okay, explain to me why they're not persons.
Sure. The word person is not defined in RFRA, and the question is, what did Congress mean when it used the word person? Well, person in the constitutional sense does not include aliens abroad, and in RFRA, all Congress intended to do was to restore free exercise rights for those individuals who had constitutional free exercise rights. The text of the statute and the legislative history and the findings in the statute all made clear that what Congress wanted to do was roll back the clock on constitutional free exercise rights to the high point under Sherbert and Yoder, and there's no suggestion that Congress intended to bestow free exercise rights on individuals who never had those rights before, namely aliens abroad. The word person in the abstract is an undefined term. In the constitutional sense, we know what it means. And the issue here is simply, did Congress intend to adopt the constitutional definition or something more robust? And again, based upon the text of the statute, the purpose, the legislative history, we submit that Congress was intending to use the constitutional definition. But if I may, even if this court were to disagree with me on that, at the very least, the word is ambiguous, the word person in this sense. And because it's ambiguous, there aren't any clearly established rights here. At the very least, defendants should prevail on the second step of qualified immunity.
I thought your argument was a bit more subtle than that. I thought the argument was, first of all, the original statute only applied to the exercise of the of religious freedom under the First Amendment, the Free Exercise Clause. That's number one, and that's clear. Number two, the 11th Circuit had held that the First Amendment doesn't apply at Guantanamo, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Congress amended the statute, but it didn't. There's no indication that the amendment meant to expand the category of people who were covered. In fact, what it did was contract the universe of people because it couldn't apply to the states, right?
That's correct.
But they changed the definition of religion. And so your point is that there's no indication that the amendment was meant to overrule the 11th Circuit, apply the statute beyond the sovereign territory of the United States. Therefore, and you can get there in a couple different ways. I thought you were arguing. One is the definition of persons, and two, the definition of what the exercise of religion covers.
That's correct, Your Honor. And everything you said, we agree with absolutely. And if the court went down that road, we would agree with 100% of that analysis.
Do you agree that you can get damages under this statute?
No, Your Honor, not against individuals in their personal capacity. We don't agree with that. We didn't raise that issue in this case. We lost it in a few district courts, but we do agree with the suggestion that RFRA does not provide for damages action against individuals in their personal capacity.
It doesn't say, the statute doesn't, it just says appropriate relief.
Correct, Your Honor.
Right.
And it's relief against the government, and an individual working in his personal capacity is not the government. So there are many reasons why plaintiff's claim under RFRA does not prevail under the step one of qualified immunity, but at the very least, it fails under the second step because there are all these questions out there and the statute's ambiguous.
You didn't have to file a 1292B certificate because you can appeal qualified immunity denial and that brings up subsidiary questions?
Correct, Your Honor. So if the court has no further questions, I'm happy to rest.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Does Mr. Lewis have any time left? All right, why don't you take 3 minutes?
Very quickly, the government does not deal with the issue of whether the Westfall Act inquiry is a question of fact. It is a question of fact, and Ballinger, which they've cited as the leading case, was a case which was decided after discovery and an evidentiary hearing. And we would submit that Westfall requires that discovery and the evidentiary hearing. Moving quickly to RFRA. RFRA did expand the scope beyond what was granted by the First Amendment, and indeed the 2000 amendments to RFRA made clear that the touchstone was no longer the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment. First, it expanded it to territories and possessions, and it was not clear before that the insular cases extended the First Amendment as a fundamental right. So it applied in places.
No, extended to the governments of territories and possessions. They were the, what do they call it, competent entity or something?
Covered entities.
Covered entities, right.
Well, so to officials who are in those places.
Right.
And it extended it to conduct in those places when it wasn't before. It extended it to statutes of neutral application, which the First Amendment had not done before. It extended it to prisons, as we have here, because the Supreme Court in the Alone versus Shabazz case had severely limited the applicability of the First Amendment to prisons. It extended it to the military. Under Goldman versus Weinberger, facially neutral regulations did not give First Amendment protection. So military, prisons, and other places. And the Supreme Court recognized in the city of Boone what a significant expansion it was. We submitted in our Rule 28J letter the Navajo Nation case, which also made clear that the RFRA is not simply a codification of the First Amendment. Next, I'd like to refer the court to Hamdi. The government.
What is your definition of religion?
Of religion? Well, under RFRA, it is the practice, it's not for the court or the governments. If someone has a sincerely held religious belief, a practice that extends to that.
You can't define religion by referring to a religious belief because it's purely circular.
Well, I would suggest that Islam fits within any definition of religion, and I don't think the government...
I don't have any doubt about that. I'm just wondering about your proposition that it expanded beyond the free exercise clause, which would, to my mind, would mean that it expanded, has to expand the definition of religion.
No, it expanded
otherwise,
it in,
I
that,
don't understand the
in that statutes of neutral applicability, which burdened religion, were not, were under the balancing test of free exercise previously in place, were no longer...
You're using that in the sense that it overruled Smith.
Well, it also overruled Goldman v. Weinberger. It also overruled Alon versus Shabazz, and it also extended it in places that it hadn't been before: prisons, the military, outside the United States. Picking up on Judge Brown's question, persons is a very broad term. Congress knows what it's doing when it chooses those terms. There is nothing in the legislative history suggests that it meant persons to exclude my clients, who are persons. And that there is no support in the legislative history or in any case or anywhere else.
What do you do with the Fifth Amendment? No person shall be deprived of property, life, et cetera, liberty without due process.
But there are numerous the statutory construction methods that are used by courts don't start with that, and they have looked at numerous other cases. There are numerous cases cited in our brief which say when Congress wants to say persons include citizens but not resident aliens, or Congress includes citizens and resident aliens but not people outside the United States, they know how to do that. And it's significant that when the MCA and the DTA were passed against this entire background, they did not exclude persons who had not been found to be enemy combatants. And I would suggest, Your Honor, that to construe that statute and the plain language of persons as not including these people when the Fifth Amendment doesn't apply would be improperly using the principles of statutory construction, particularly when it is clear that RFRA would apply to people who would not get Fifth Amendment protection under the Constitution.
One of the principles of statutory construction that constrains us is that that statutes of the United States are not to be given extraterritorial effect unless there clearly stays a presumption against it.
Well, there is a
isn't that one of the principles?
There is a presumption against extraterritorial effect. This is not extraterritorial effect because Guantanamo has been found is a possession of the United States. And second, that presumption applies in cases where the concern is that Congress has no measure of legislative authority, where there is some measure of legislative authority, as in the Foley brothers. Excuse me,
Mr. Your Honor. Maybe I'm misunderstanding, but your argument is not restricted. If we followed your argument, it's not restricted to Guantanamo. It would apply in Afghanistan. It would apply in prisons that run by the United States in Iraq. It would apply anywhere in the world. The statute would apply. Isn't that right?
No, that's not. It can be applied to Guantanamo and not applied more broadly under the territories and possessions language.
Yeah, but that only deals with the government of a territory or possession. The individuals, and that provision defines who is restrained by this statute. It's the government of the United States. It's the government of our territories. It's the government of our possession. Those are the officials. But all the officials here, we've been through this, are officials of the United States that you sued. So therefore, there's no territorial restriction whatsoever under your argument.
Well, I would suggest that the commander of Gitmo could be considered an official who is an official of that covered entity. I think that's certainly a construction of the statute.
What about Donald Rumsfeld? Who's he an official of?
Well, he's an official of the United States, and on the face of the statute, it applies to him. Now, there is legislative history.
It would apply to him even with regard to the, you know, Abu Ghraib or any prison in Afghanistan or any prison in Iraq or any prison in Landsberg prison in Germany.
Indeed, Your Honor, there was legislative history. Senator Thurman said, won't this be applied on military bases in Saudi Arabia? And Congress went ahead and passed it anyway.
Yeah.
So while we think there is a limiting principle, it is a very broad statute.
What was the answer to his question?
The answer to his question was, well, it was a comment which was not followed up on, and they passed the language of the statute anyway, yeah, under the RLUIPA amendments in 2000.
So you agree that your argument would lead to application in military bases in Saudi Arabia?
Well, Your Honor, one case, that is a possible construction, but one case at a time. That's not our case. Thank you, Your Honor.